You were at the Atlantic, show my ignorance here. Atlantic Council now, or
what's the sign?
There you go.
Of course. No.
Yeah. How are you?
Getting adjusted.
Yeah, I've been there about a month. So.
Hi, everyone. We're going to get started with our third panel of the day. So please find your seats. Please come back. It's starting now. I'm going to give it to David.
PLA stock closing.
I told you to recognize.
No, I have no job for quite a while. Oh, yeah, there's a whole Twitter.
Oh, yeah. He
has a mustache.
Have people talked about it yet?
No, it should be raised.
I'm going to.
Good.
You ready to start?
Right.
All right, hello. Good afternoon for our first panel this afternoon on regional security trends and U.S.-Taiwan security cooperation. So before I introduce our speakers, I want to start with some brief remarks that the U.S. and Taiwan have a robust security cooperation relationship today, which is a legacy of the fact that Taiwan was a mutual defense treaty ally of the U.S. up until 1979. Taiwan's brightest young military officers study at the U.S. Naval Academy, Citadel, and other military academies. Senior military officers meet with their counterparts at the Pentagon to conduct military diplomacy, join in the Taiwan political military visit organized by the U.S. State Department, and interact with U.S. officials at the annual Monterey talks. We're all aware of U.S. arms sales to Taiwan and the important role this plays in light of the ever-growing cross-strait military imbalance. Yet Taiwan is an underutilized partnership. Even though most of Taiwan's advanced military equipment is U.S. origin, which means that they are potentially interoperable with the U.S. military, and a helpful asset in international humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, or in a potential conflict. The region is heating up with North Korea's nuclear tests and missile launches, China's island building in the South China Sea, among other pressing security concerns. How can the U.S. and Taiwan strengthen security cooperation? Many other questions remain, such as for regional security trends. Taiwan currently possesses Itu Aba Island in the South China Sea, and its Coast Guard is stationed there. With the benefit of this strategic position, how can Taiwan play a more constructive role with the U.S. and its partners in the South China Sea? As North Korea is testing greater yields of nuclear weapons and longer distance missiles, the same capabilities that enable North Korea to fly missiles over Japan and possibly strike Guam are the same capabilities that put Taiwan within range. How much should Taiwan be concerned, and does it have a role to play in this regard? For U.S.-Taiwan security cooperation, in my 6 years working on arms sales at the U.S. State Department, we followed the Taiwan Relations Act closely, which we discussed this morning, and which states verbatim the United States, quote, will make available Taiwan such defense articles and defense services in such quantity as may be necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability, end quote. Rather than holding arms sales requests from Taiwan for sometimes over a year, is there a way to regularize the process? Perhaps back to the annual review or even more frequent than on an annual basis? U.S. defense companies were there when Taiwan needed help building its indigenous defense fighter aircraft in the 1980s. How can the U.S. help with Taiwan's future indigenous defense diesel electric submarine? Should Taiwan's new submarine be a large platform like U.S. submarines, such as the Ohio class with its 18,000-ton displacement and 560-foot length, which is 170 meters. Instead, should it be a more moderate size and displacement submarine, or even a swarm of small unmanned underwater vehicles instead of manned submarines? With these questions in mind, I will introduce my panelists and possibly circle back to these questions later on after they give their statements during the Q&A. To make brief introductions, Abraham Denmark, to my left, is a director of the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, which conducts independent research and hosts frank dialogues to develop actionable ideas for Congress, the administration, and the broader policy community on issues related to the Asia-Pacific. He also holds a joint appointment as a senior fellow at the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the United States. Prior to joining the Wilson Center, Mr. Denmark served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense for East Asia, where he supported the Secretary of Defense and other senior U.S. government leaders in the formulation and implementation of national security strategies and defense policies toward the region. To his left, Mark Stokes is the Executive Director of the Project 2049 Institute. Previously, he was a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and member of the Board of Governors of the American Chamber of Commerce in Taiwan, as well as other various senior positions in the private sector. A 20-year U.S. Air Force veteran, Stokes also served as a team chief and senior country director for the People's Republic of China, Taiwan and Mongolia, and the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. Lieutenant General, General Wallace Chip Gregson, retired, most recently served as Assistant Secretary of Defense, Asia and Pacific Security Affairs. Previously, he served as the Chief Operating Officer for the United States Olympic Committee, then as an independent consultant before entering the government in 2009. From 2003 to 2005, he was Commanding General of the Marine Corps Forces Pacific and Marine Corps Forces Central Command, where he led and managed over 70,000 Marines and sailors in the Middle East, Afghanistan, East Africa, Asia, and the United States. Oriana Schuyler Mastro is an assistant professor of security studies at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, where her research focuses on Chinese military and security policy, Asia-Pacific security issues, war termination, and coercive diplomacy. She is also in the United States Air Force Reserve, where she works as a political military strategist for PACAF, Pacific Air Force. She is a Jean Kirkpatrick Scholar at AEI for the year as well. She holds a PhD in politics from Princeton University. So with that introduction, I'll turn it over for each speaker to make his or her remarks for about 10 minutes, and we'll circle back with some discussion and question and answers. So Abe, if you could please start.
Great, thank you. And thank you to GTI for inviting me today. It's great to see so many old friends, and really appreciate you inviting me in. First, I wanted to start, before I get into the substance of my talk, I wanted to start by congratulating GTI on the tremendous success. In a remarkably short amount of time, GTI has become a leading voice on the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. And I just wanted to express my congratulations to Chairman Lai and the rest of the leadership there. Also to congratulate Russell and his mustache for your leadership.
The mustache.
Which I understand has its own Twitter account, so I recently became a follower. Because I'm on a panel with so many illustrious experts, I wanted to use my position as sort of the first speaker for the panel to try to set the table for where I think some of the high-level issues that we have in our relationship. I really wanted to start with the observation that a lot of the discussion that we have when it comes to the U.S.-Taiwan defense relationship is really in the ways and means area of strategy. As you all know, any real strategy is composed of three elements, ends being what you want to accomplish, ways being how you want to accomplish it, and then means being what you want to accomplish it with. And we tend to focus on the third category in conversations about Taiwan's defense. What sort of capabilities? And a lot of the details were mentioned in the introduction today of a diesel-electric submarine. How long should it be? How much should it weigh? What kind of fighter aircraft should Taiwan have? What kind of unmanned vehicles should it have? Those sorts of things. And those are important conversations to have. But I'm afraid that over the years, that the conversations about the means have at times overshadowed discussion about ends and ways. So I think it's important. This is the first point I wanted to make. I think it's important in our defense relationship that we get back to the basics of strategy and focus on the ends, ways, and means of how together we're going to secure Taiwan. And I think there's a lot that needs to be done in this way. First point under this is that writing about strategy doesn't actually make it a strategy. In fact, a lot of the writings that you read when it comes to strategy for Taiwan tends to focus on the ends or on sort of operational concepts. But really, a real strategy that can military planners can build off of is an integration of all three of these pieces of end, ways, and means. And it's been a long time since we've been able to do that together in a real cohesive way. I think it's time, considering the evolution of the threat that Taiwan faces from the People's Republic of China, I think there's a real need for us to be able to work on this together. We can't focus on ways or means in isolation. And too often, I'm afraid, that when people talk about strategy to defend Taiwan, it tends to be the point of the analysis tends to be focusing on a specific capability and then developing a rationale for that capability, rather than building a strategy, developing operational concepts to enable that, and then figuring out how we're going to do that in a way that's actionable. So the first recommendation that I'd have for how we do this, when I'm talking about getting back to the basics of fundamentals of developing a strategy, is establishing an integrated planning and strategy effort between the United States and Taiwan, in which our planners can get together and figure out, with political support, with input from those who determine how many resources we're able to devote to this, what kind of technologies we'll be able to transfer, really bringing all the key voices together to identify what are our ends, what are our ways, and what are our means. And the reason we need to bring all these people together is that if any one piece of this falls apart, we're not able to deliver any one piece of this puzzle, then the whole thing falls apart. If our planners are able to come together and develop a common strategy, common ends, develop an operational approach that we all agree to, and then we develop means that, for whatever reason, Taiwan isn't able to buy it, or the technology is not able to get transferred for whatever reason, then the whole thing falls apart. So we need to be able to make sure that each piece of the puzzle is able to fit together as it's being developed. And I would argue that that's a key piece to do that, and working on it together. This is especially important as Taiwan remains dependent on the United States for a lot of your capabilities. There's despite a lot of the talk and analysis and investment that's been made on indigenous development, which I think is important and I think is definitely worthwhile, Taiwan is still going to remain at least somewhat dependent on American technology and American capabilities through the various mechanisms that we have. And because of that, I think every piece of the strategy from ends, ways, and means needs to be developed together in a comprehensive way. So that's the first and probably the main point I want to make. In terms of thinking about ways to enhance our defense relationship, quite a bit of the conversation recently I've noticed has been very focused on symbology, be it from talk about including Taiwan in multilateral exercises like Red Flag or major exercises at PACOM, to having senior officials visit, whether or not our military people in Taiwan wear uniforms. And symbolism is important, but as a former defense official, I've always been focused, and I think our relationship should always be focused on the pragmatic defense cooperation. That, to me, the real symbol of whether or not we have a good relationship is not on whether or not this individual is wearing a uniform, but what that individual is doing when they're in Taiwan. And that's what brings deterrence, that's what brings capability, and that's what brings defense. So when people raise to me the prospect of new exercises or bringing Taiwan into existing exercises, I think, to me, the first question, and really the only question, it would be, how does this help Taiwan defend itself? How does this help the United States and Taiwan work together to defend it? And I think in a lot of the proposals that have come out recently, once you get past the symbology, there really isn't that much there. My preference, what I would hope to see, would be the development of exercises, either new exercises or adjusting existing exercises towards something that's more pragmatic in a way that can help Taiwan. And this is, I think, even could go into other areas of defense cooperation beyond exercises to real cooperation, be it in missile defense or maritime security, whatever it may be. Again, I think the first and only question is, how does this help the United States and Taiwan defend Taiwan? So then the last point, two final points I wanted to make, and I expect we'll talk about the South China Sea a bit more. But I hope this is an area of discussion, because I actually think that, to my perspective, Taiwan's approach to the South China Sea has been a real challenge in our relationship. In that, the American approach of embracing international law, concerns about mainland China's broader ambitions in the South China Sea, so far, in my estimation, Taiwan's approach has not been helpful from an American perspective, and in some ways may actually be a bit of a hindrance in our relationship. But the last point I wanted to make, and I see I'm getting close in terms of time, is really to ask a question. And I think it's an open question, in that only a few people in the current administration would be able to answer it, and I suspect that those who could answer it probably won't. and I wouldn't ask them to. As a former official. During President Trump's meeting with Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago and subsequently, it was made very clear that the North Korea issue had been put at the center of the U.S.-China relationship. And President Trump put a great deal of Xi Jinping's credibility on his ability to deliver on North Korea. And I think that's been made very clear. The fact that China has disappointed in this area. Maybe I'd say predictably disappointed, but disappointed nonetheless, that China has not held North Korea to account to the degree that most Americans would want. The question is, does this open up other areas in the U.S.-China relationship for creativity, for new policy initiatives that otherwise would be more difficult? And for this context, I think specifically, does this raise new options in our relationship with Taiwan? That if the North Korea issue is at the center of our relationship and China has failed to deliver, is the current administration more willing to consider new initiatives and expanding our defense, economic, or political relationship, not within the same existing framework that we've had for a long time, but is there an opportunity to expand that relationship since the North Korea issue has been such a problem in our relationship with the mainland? Again, I don't know the answer to that question. My personal opinion is that the U.S. relationship with Taiwan should be valued as a thing on itself and not dependent on the current status of the relationship with the mainland. But the president made this very clear. In his previous statements, there had been suggestions of ties between various unrelated issues in our relationship to China. And I think it begs the question, now that China has failed to deliver on North Korea to the degree that the United States had hoped, what does that mean for other issues in the U.S.-China relationship, including, for this audience, the U.S. unofficial relationship with Taiwan? I'll stop there.
Great. Next, we have Mark Stotes from Project 2049.
Thank you. Thank you, David, and to the Rustache, Russell, and to the Global Taiwan Institute for the invitation to come and talk about one of my favorite subjects, and it's also an honor to be here presenting with esteemed colleagues. I worked for General Gregson during a time in OSD, and it was a
we were
it was
in the same
experience.
Office. I'm never quite sure that Mark was working for me.
I have a lot of respect for him. He was a great supervisor. It was a great experience. As David mentioned, I was in I was in the Pentagon for 9 years, 2 years on the Air Staff doing. Deliberate planning or contingency planning, you know, watching out for U.S. Air Force equities, and then 7 years in OSD, handling at the staff level, handling China and Taiwan issues. Taiwan, a whole range of security assistance and other bilateral exchange issues, arms sales to be included, and then also some military with China. And then after these years, I took a deep dive and went from the ivory tower of policy down to the deep, dark recesses of business in Taiwan, and it was quite the shock, but also very educational, because I came away after 4 years with some. It took a while to sort of have it sink in, but with some sort of profound lessons. And one of the most profound of these lessons was It can be obvious to some, especially if you're from Taiwan. But to me, it was pretty profound because I've been in the policy world, and it was a totally different sort of environment. And that most profound takeaway is that Taiwan, under its existing Republic of China constitution, under its current ROC constitution, exists as an independent sovereign state. This is objective reality. And I may get rotten tomatoes thrown at me for even raising this issue, and depending on various perspectives. There are some that believe the ROC doesn't exist, doesn't have legitimacy, it's an occupying force. If that's a perspective, one has to remember that the fundamental nature of the ROC changed with the first direct presidential election in 1996. It changed fundamentally again with the first peaceful transition of power in 2000, again 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016. This is not the same ROC that it used to be. And so with that objective reality in mind, that's not the same as the recognition of it as such. There's a difference between the objective reality of Taiwan or ROC and how we deal with it. And this is one of the most fundamental security challenges that I think the United States faces in the future, is how to overcome this disconnect between the objective reality and a policy that doesn't come in line with this sort of objective reality. I think Randy Forbes put it best, and that's that the status quo is the existence of two legitimate governments on both sides of the strait. That's the status quo. So I raise this because when you talk about the security situation, and I commend making this panel about the security rather than just defense, because it's important we look at security issues as a look beyond just the military. That's one of the issues, I think, is that we tend to look purely at the military aspects when security issues are much broader and very much related to this disconnect between objective reality and the policies that we adopt approach. It certainly is fundamental to the way the PRC would reflect or would think about their security policy, and very much fundamental to Taiwan in terms of their... when we talk about, for example, submarines or advanced fighters, we forget that these are inherently strategic systems. And I'll get to these issues later, but the political aspects of security are very important, as are economic aspects of security, as are there from PRC perspective, Taiwan perspective, there's cultural aspects, and there's also military. From China's perspective, it has a one China principle in which there's one China, Taiwan's part of China, and the PRC is the sole representative of China in the national community. Well, maybe, it depends, that certainly is, that they certainly want to implement this, their view of one country, two systems, as this would be called, not just across the Taiwan Strait, but internationally as well, in Washington, D.C. There's a conscious effort, and it has been for a long time, but it's becoming even more intense, on trying to implement their solution, One China Principle, internationally in Washington, D.C., and have it reflect U.S. policy, or at least be able to shape perceptions to get the U.S. to change its One China Policy, which has never been defined. Can anybody define it? I see John Tasek. He's done one of the best about highlighting that it can't be defined and it shouldn't be defined. And as John mentioned in some of his writings, Jim Kelly probably put it the best in 2005, I believe, in testimony before Congress when he said, when asked, can you define One China? And he said, no, I don't think I can define it, but I'll tell you what it's not. It is not Beijing's One China principle. Maybe it may have some context, but it's very important. And so the PRC, or China's objective, in my view, is... not so much military, certainly that has its important element, but they like to leverage all forms of, all instruments of power, and this includes political, it includes cultural, everything's defined in terms of warfare. You have, you have cultural warfare, you have deterrence warfare, you have all kinds, the three warfares, public opinion warfare, which is propaganda, psychological warfare, legal warfare. And then you have the military aspects. It's useful to remember that within the PLA, there are, in terms of structurally wise, they have an entire organization that would be roughly, if you can imagine a Central Intelligence Agency or a National Security Agency or a DIA, that's dedicated to nothing but subversion, dedicated to nothing but covert propaganda, to what some would call, three warfares is different, but they have an entire organization that's equivalent to their rough counterpart of NSA, and DIA and CIA, that's dedicated to what you would call psychological warfare, covert propaganda, things like this. Beyond that, they have an entire core level, core grade organization, technically deputy corps, but still equivalent to all the conventional ballistic missiles they have opposite Taiwan, called the Base 311, aka 3 Wolfers Base, headquartered in Fuzhou, that's dedicated to nothing but subversion against Taiwan, increasingly against others around in the United States and elsewhere. But it is a significant challenge, with the goal being to be able to exploit divisions within Taiwan. It doesn't matter between DPP and KMT, within the KMT, within the DPP, between Taiwan and the United States, is dedicated to this. Many people in this room may have had exposure to some individuals who are associated with this, and you probably won't know it because they tend to be either semi-covert or clandestine. But this is very important to look at this. PLA is modernizing across the board and getting better. They're not 10 feet tall yet, but the political aspects of their military strategy are critical and something that's often ignored. Taiwan's security perspective, it's a significant challenge. It's a very challenging environment. Diverse demands on finite resources. In terms of defining national security, any attempt to define or to look at Taiwan defense strategy without looking at national security objectives is going to be off base. And it goes to that fundamental issue what I mentioned before, that Taiwan, under its current ROC, is an independent sovereign state. That's a driver on so many levels that's often missed when you only look at things from a military perspective. Economy is very important. It's a security. It's economic security. And economic infrastructure requires investments and resources, all the way from investments into science technology, S&T, R&D. There were statements made at least back in the 2000s, a commitment to be able to increase R&D investments up to 3% of GDP. Hasn't quite made it yet, but that's often missed. Bear in mind demographics, increasingly aging society, which means there's going to be more requirements on Social Security. Living in Taiwan, the national health insurance system, in my view, is ideal. It is convenient, but it costs money. It costs a significant part of the budget. Non-traditional security, remember that Taiwan, in 2005, in a UN study on the most dangerous place on Earth, was tied for the top two for the most dangerous place on Earth due to natural disasters. People forget about this. And it's a requirement on resources. So budget issues are significant. You have the military budget. So bear in mind there are competitions, and they're all important. And I'll get to the reason why this is important later. U.S. security perspective, U.S. policy is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, informed by the three communiques. The TRA, don't forget that very important clause in the TRA, and there are more that are more well-informed on this, but if I'm not mistaken, that according to U.S. law, Taiwan shall not be treated in a manner different than it had been before the TRA was enacted in 1979. I think that's very important. But beyond that, two security-related provisions. One of them is the U.S. policy to be able to maintain the capacity to resist use of force and other forms of coercion. Very important. It can be interpreted in different ways. In my way I interpret it, for deliberate planning purposes, a Taiwan scenario should be number one driver for U.S. force planning. There are other contingencies out there, but just as a basic force planner, a Taiwan contingency, in my view, is important and should stay that way. Not South China Sea is important, but Taiwan should be free. And then a provision of necessary defense articles and services. So here's just your general perspectives on the security situation. So going back and looking at other aspects of U.S. policy, in terms of some of the issues that are at the forefront today, one is criticism over Taiwan's defense budget. Taiwan needs to spend more, dedicate the resources necessary for defense. Again, bear in mind, the takeaway that I had from in Taiwan, when I was in policy, we had standard talking points that we used. You know, don't play political football with the special budget. Once I arrived in Taiwan, I started hearing the same words. There was something about that it just, I viewed them in a very different way. Maybe because of the business I was in. From in Taiwan, if you saw, for example, remarks by a legislator named Liao, who talked about U.S. arms sales being what he called a running dog or kites at a jungo, things like this. It made it sound like the U.S. is only interested in arms sales, is only interested in making money. And certainly Beijing exploited this propaganda for their purposes. So that was a problematic. The F-16s, the submarines, have long been a source of debate. I may get to that later in the... But it goes back to that idea. There's nothing that spells sovereignty like a diesel electric submarines. Nothing that spells sovereignty like that. A country has submarines. A country has an air force. There certainly are there are military reasons for these for justifications, but sometimes there may be other of these underlying assumptions. RIMPAC, exercise observation, and all kinds of other things. I would make three recommendations and then close it after that. The first is from a broader security perspective, people-to-people exchanges are very important. Why do we have a high-level dialogue with the PRC, or at least had a high-level mechanism for people-to-people exchange with Beijing, headed by the vice president on our side and Liu Yandong, vice premier of the PRC on their side. Why do we have that with China and not with Taiwan? Why don't we have some kind of a similar mechanism for that at senior levels? To me, it makes a lot of sense. Whatever reasons are justified that high-level mechanism with Beijing exists for Taiwan, but maybe with some possible exceptions. Number two, defense industry is very important in Taiwan. I think that is one of the most, the emphasis that President Tsai places on defense industry, I think, is very well placed. And for good reasons. If you want to have a higher defense budget, you need to be able to do something to be able to generate more interest. You need to be able to have jobs that are created at the local level. You need to have concepts or technology spinoffs. And the U.S. has a very important role to play in this. I think actually, as Deputy Secretary of Defense, I think even Abe had raised this in some of his presentations, and I think it's well on the mark. Perhaps thinking closely about having a bilateral joint working group on defense industrial cooperation and supply chain security. I raise supply chain security. Think about the presidential executive order that was issued about a month ago. Bear in mind the role that Taiwan plays in our supply chain. Very important, I think, to get a handle on these things. And then finally, I would argue we need to think carefully about the structure of our defense relationship and to think about the way it was done in the past and why it was done the way it was in the past between 82 and 2001. And I would argue in favor of bringing back the arms sales talks as an annual basis, either in itself as an additional channel or maybe as a subset of the DRTs. But something that is dedicated to nothing where Taiwan can present its list of its arms sales in terms of what they believe to be requirements and something that forces a decision within a relatively decent time frame, 3 months. And so with that, thanks again, and turn it back over to you, Dave.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark. And General Gregson, please.
Everybody take a deep breath. I'm sure you're breathless after that 60 terabyte data pack. You can see why working with Mark when I was in the Pentagon the first time was such a pleasure. Let me go to part of the title of this session, which was regional trends, and let me start from the macro and I'll work my way down. First regional trend here is the reemergence of great power competition and a shift in the international order from a unipolar structure to something much less stable under a multipolar system. This latest unipolar moment lasted only a little bit longer than our previous unipolar moment right after the end of World War II, but we keep hoping that it'll come back. Collapse of Marxist communism as a pillar supporting communist rule of China, leaving only economic success and nationalism as the two justifications for continued Chinese Communist Party rule of that nation. We know that economies wax and wane, they're cyclical, putting even more pressure on ardent nationalism as one of the justifications. North Korea's missiles and nuclear development. The question that was asked earlier today was, what's our strategy toward Asia? Right now, it's all about North Korea. So this is bending things in that direction. This is a fundamental challenge to our alliances and to our U.S. deterrent guarantees. And we've been working this problem since 1994, the agreed framework, the Korean Economic Development Organization, all these other things. We've had more than one round of sanctions where we said, this time we'll fix it. And here we are. We're about this far from a deliverable nuclear weapon. And it's incumbent upon the United States to react and react vigorously to this to make sure, not leaving North Korea aside and China aside for the moment, most important, that we restore the faith of our allies in the validity of our defense capabilities and the validity of our deterrent. This may very well, and this might have an impact on Taiwan, this may very well and should mean that we are enhancing our alliance capabilities. China should be informed that if you can't or won't help us with North Korea, then we have no other choice but to reinforce our alliance capabilities. This is nothing personal toward you. This is just business. Our U.S. vital interests are at stake here, and we will react accordingly. And if that means TMD for Taiwan at some point in the future, Never let a crisis go to waste. This might be a way to do it. The pivot as a whole of government effort, and Mark spoke eloquently about not just military things, but the original announcement of the pivot to Asia was a whole of government effort. The way then Secretary Clinton laid it out, the military wasn't even mentioned, but it was down the long list of things. With the collapse of TPP and the last three remaining viable presidential candidates all turned against trade, with the collapse of TPP, this was a terrific own goal, and it took the non-military aspect of the pivot off the table, leaving us with nothing but the military means there in Asia, and that's not a whole of government effort. We need to get something back on that, but that's something we have to deal with right now. Philippine authoritarianism and their accommodation to China is a problem for us. Also, our other unmentioned ally, or one of the remaining unmentioned allies, Thailand, is cozying up to China because of alliance difficulties with the United States. This is not a trend in Taiwan's favor or the U.S. favor. Chinese South Sea land creation and militarization efforts. This was done with the added benefit of massive environmental damage to the South China Sea. Professor McManus, Dr. McManus, at the University of Miami, has done a lot of study on this, and Dr. McManus is convinced that this is risking collapse of the entire South China Sea ecosystem and resultant food shortages in that region of Asia. If you're Philippine or Vietnamese, you're not exactly a major cattle growing organization, so your source of protein comes from the sea, and right now they're not able to fish in their traditional fishing grounds. It's a pervasive belief in America that these small land features are meaningless. They're not significant. Mischief Reef is as big as Washington, D.C. Subi Reef is as big as Pearl Harbor. And these are all pretty significant geographic features that we think of. The undisputed historical sovereignty mantra has been adopted by the PRC leadership, including personally President Xi Jinping. Because of this adoption of this undisputed historical sovereignty thing, there is no room for the senior Chinese leadership to compromise, either explicitly or tacitly. So this is stuck, this is a major impact. In response, we said we're going to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows. We went back and forth on a few very well-telegraphed freedom of navigation operations, and then we got into an argument of whether it was down in the weeds of innocent passage or whether it really was freedom of navigation operations. Doesn't matter. Carrier battle groups are wonderful things, but they don't do much for the Vietnamese fishermen or Philippine fishermen that are not able to exercise their rights to fish in their own places now. Hong Kong pressurization, it seems that the second system of one country, two systems is under severe pressure now. PRC-Japan relations, historical issues, are useful nationalism fuel. And under the increasing seaborne incursions into Japanese territory and the increasing Russian and Chinese aerial intrusions into Japanese territory, the aerial intrusions have exceeded maximum Cold War levels. Both of these efforts are cost-imposing measures on Japan because it takes fuel, it takes airplanes, it takes energy to counter all these intrusions, the same thing on the seaborne side. China-South Korea relations. China obviously cares much more about the effect of the theater high-altitude area defense on Chinese security than they care about the North Korean nuclear weapons effect on the security of our allies. The fact that we put up with this is something that we have to stop doing. We have to say that these complaints have no validity, and we have to start calling out China on their punishment of South Korean firms for this and their tourism cutoff in Japan. The century of humiliation rhetoric, this started some time ago. This is another thing that contributes to now starting to drive discussions. Once you let loose the dogs of nationalism, they take you in directions where you can't. Again, Xi Jinping and the other leaders of China cannot compromise or turn back from this. Besides the PLA, which we're always fond of counting, the maritime militia power is growing, 205 ships and climbing now. These ships are armed. Some are larger than Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, and explicit statements on the Chinese part about these ships being specifically built to ram other ships should be concerning. President Xi is driving for absolute power like Mao. He's already been declared the core leader. And there was a recent report where there's speculation that Xi Jinping may have the word thought attributed to him. The last person to have thought attributed to him in his position was Mao Zedong, so this might indicate where we're going. PLA reorganization, very briefly, this is going away from static defense of Chinese territory as we understand it to being much more oriented towards power projection operations. They've got a growing arsenal of land-based weapons, and a lot of their activities around the South China Sea and the East China Sea are an awful lot like proof of concept for potential operations to attack Taiwan. On that happy note, I relinquish the chair.
Thank you, General Gregson. Oriana from Georgetown University.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here today. It's always an honor to serve on such panels as well as to go last. So I tried to predict what everyone else was going to say and see if I could come up with anything different, given that obviously the gentlemen here have a wide range of experience in this area. So I am going to go even higher, broader in terms of how I look at strategic trends. But before I do so, given my background is a bit diverse, I just need to say that obviously any of the views that I express here today are my own and don't represent any of the organizations with which I am affiliated. So it's actually interesting to give this talk today because right after this at 3:30, I'm going to talk to undergrads about U.S. policy towards Taiwan and have them read the Taiwan Relations Act, which is always a fascinating experience because most people know what it is. They have assumptions of what it says, but very few have actually read it. And so it's good to talk to broader audiences about some new ideas that I've had of late. So regional security trends, what I want to talk to you today is about a few things that I think are emerging that are going to impact Taiwan and the United States, and I'll talk a bit about what I think it means for cooperation between those two countries. The first issue has been brought up before, and that's the immediacy of the North Korean issue and how it's really obscuring significant long-term challenges that both the United States and Taiwan face in the region. And that is obviously having to do with the rise of China. I think it's a very important issue. I myself just finished a year-long fellowship here at the CFR as a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow, where I spent the whole year looking at Chinese contingency planning and capabilities to denuclearize the peninsula by force. So I think a lot of time has to be spent on it. But obviously, as Abe mentioned, this administration seems to be focusing very heavily on this issue and not looking at the broader picture of what certain types of behaviors, norms, institutions are meaning for the future stability and security of the region. And as long as the United States is primarily focused on this, I think this is going to not be to the benefit of Taiwan, and Taiwan should think about potentially taking advantage or seeking some opportunities given that focus, as was mentioned by previous panelists. The second trend that I see has been mentioned, but I see it a bit differently, and that's the role of domestic politics and all these countries involved. As Americans sometimes go to Taiwan, people of Taiwan come to the United States, there's always this discussion about how domestic politics lead to suboptimal strategic and defense decisions. And to be fair, in both countries. So the last time I was in Taiwan last year, there was a lot of discussion, obviously, about the indigenous programs. It was mentioned, you know, any country has a submarine. A lot of countries don't, especially land-based countries. And I would still say that that they are countries in and of their own right. So it's this competition of you have it, we have it, this type of back and forth. In my mind, there's a lot of this going on in the North Korean issue and the Taiwan issue of we're too busy trying to look strong that we're actually not acting strong. And this sort of constant fear of looking weak and showing credibility is actually making it more difficult to make sound strategic decisions. So what's interesting to me is this domestic public opinion in Taiwan. I think it's leading, this desire to buy and sell weapons that are made in Taiwan. In my understanding, it's primarily to boost the Taiwan economy, create jobs, retain local talent. And in the United States, we have the same type of pressures. So the question then becomes, instead of kind of complaining about how domestic politics constantly gets in the way of making sound strategic decisions in the United States and Taiwan and elsewhere, what can we do to move beyond that? And I would say that there's a lot of research done about how states can use international relationships, international agreements, international institutions to bind themselves to strategically sound policies and make it more difficult for those policies not to succeed also at home. So I would say one of the things when the United States and Taiwan hopefully pursue some of the joint planning, other joint efforts, I think that Abe mentioned, that could be discussed is this challenge that we all face, which is the domestic political challenge and how it shapes our policies in ways that are not ideal, in ways that potentially we can help each other formulate the types of groups and support in each of our countries to help us along to make more sound policies. And so I think the domestic political factors, I wouldn't say that they're necessarily increasing, but what I think is interesting is that they persist, given the fact that our strategic challenges, in my mind, in the Asia-Pacific are getting harder and harder. And dealing with the rise of China and Chinese assertiveness in general is becoming much more of an issue. Great power competition is definitely at the forefront. So the fact that domestic political factors still manage to get us on the wrong track sometimes is disconcerting and something that we all need to think about. The third broad trend, I label it more players, more capabilities, factors that influence intervention. In Asia-Pacific, as you know, the countries in this region are buying more arms per year than European countries. There is a general arms buildup occurring. And one thing that we do know about capabilities is that there is a correlation between being able to do something and then being willing to do something. And so in the intervention world, there's a lot of different factors that might predict, for example, whether or not the United States is willing to intervene on Taiwan's behalf in a contingency. One of those has to do with whether or not a country has the capabilities to intervene and the balance of capabilities. And I think we all know, based on some of the statistics already given about the advancements of the Chinese military, those are going in a direction in which intervention becomes more costly, and therefore it becomes more difficult for the United States to intervene. Another factor that influences whether a country would intervene is whether they have alternative strategies that they can pursue to support their strategic objectives short of military intervention. And again, I think this is something that the United States and Taiwan can think about, because a lot of policies that might seem in support of Taiwan, perhaps giving them more autonomy in defense, for example, according to a lot of this research, if the United States feels like it has alternative ways of supporting Taiwan, it's less likely to directly support Taiwan. And that could be obviously problematic as well, given the strength of China. And the last thing has to do with the power of international norms. There's a lot of research that looks at whether or not the desire to uphold international norms can predict intervention on the behalf of an ally or a friend. And I would say that this is one of the main problems in the U.S.-Taiwan relationship, is that it has become extremely reliant on normative arguments for why this relationship should continue. And we can all have different opinions about this. Obviously, you know, as was mentioned, I myself serve in the military in the United States. I'm very supportive of the United States, believe it's a force of good in the region, and that democracy is the best system for peoples within countries. But this type of argument is losing currency given populism, economic considerations, and broader strategic concerns about the Chinese military. So I would suggest sort of a branching out of beyond the Taiwan's a democracy, United States is a democracy, what are thinking more deeply about the strategic considerations of why it is so vital that Taiwan maintains its autonomy in the face of increasing pressure and potentially coercion on the part of the PRC. The next trend, or I'd say a broad issue that I talk about a lot, I just wrote a piece about Doklam along these lines, but I think it broadly pertains to China and to the region in general. There's a lot of core interests, you know, for the China says these are things that, you know, are unwilling to compromise, and you can use different terminologies, but sovereignty, disputes, every country in the region has certain things that they're unwilling to compromise on. And the United States, its military strategy, in my view, has been based on cost-imposing strategies. Right? The United States military, what we do is we'll hurt you until you do what we want you to do. The problem with this in a lot of the Asia-Pacific conflicts is the benefits of success are so high, right, and the costs of failure are so high, that it is very difficult, even with the superb military might that the United States has, to be able to impose enough costs on adversaries to really serve as a deterrent. I would argue that U.S. presence in Vietnam, for example, the Vietnam War is a primary example of this. If the United States was unable to hurt Vietnam enough, North Vietnam enough to give up, I think it's highly unlikely that that is a useful strategy for a country like China. In the end, if China thinks it can succeed, then it will move. And so I think in the only thing that keeps China moving right now that imposes caution on China is uncertainty about how their military will perform. And so we have to, I would argue that what India did in Doklam, basically sitting in the center of where China wanted to go and say we're not moving, that's a brute force strategy. That's deterrence by denial. And those are more effective than deterrence by punishment when it comes to China. And the last point, since I only have a minute that I want to focus on, is also something that was previously mentioned. I think both in Taiwan and in the United States, there's been insufficient focus on innovative, strategic, and operational concepts. Both countries are hoping that technology is going to solve some of these strategic issues for us. And it makes sense, right? During the Cold War, the United States, the Soviet Union, whoever had the biggest, fastest stuff, would win the day. But the United States cannot spend its way out of the China challenge. And if the United States can't do it, Taiwan certainly cannot. And so I think moving forward, I think it's a great idea to have sort of joint integrated planning efforts, but the interoperability should move farther beyond, whether or not our aircraft can talk to each other. In my experience, the hardest aspects of, interoperability had to do with the planning and like establishing commander's guidance, in which, at least in my personal experiences, we still kind of do it separately, then come together to talk about it, then do it separately, and then come together to talk about it. And so moving forward, it really is going to be new ideas about how we use our forces, where we base them, how we integrate them with each other. That is what China is going to have a hard time countering, because they are very good at stealing technology, and they are very good at developing countermeasures in a relatively quick fashion. They're less flexible and agile when it comes to how their personnel performs. And so this is something that allows strategists and planners in the United States to sleep a little bit easier at night. Right, that Chinese, the PLA doesn't, have anything on a U.S. military member. So that's what we need to take advantage of and think about, be more flexible in those operational concepts, because if the balloon ever goes up, I think that's really what's going to be to the benefit of both Taiwan and the United States. So with that, I will conclude. Just hand it back to the chair.
Thank you, Arianna. Great. Thank you for the presentations. Very well thought out based on a lot of experience. And I'd like to start off with my earlier question on the South China Sea. So Abe made a really interesting comment about Taiwan's involvement in the South China Sea. I believe you mentioned that it was not as helpful, Taiwan's participation, based on your experience. But I think from what I've heard from the people I've talked to, we've heard that with Taiwan's position, it could be like a valuable information sharing situational awareness of the region, so it could be a beneficial role that Taiwan could play. So could you please elaborate on what you've experienced in terms of Taiwan's role in the South China Sea?
Sure. Arianna's presentation reminded me that I also should give the standard caveat of my views representing only my own and not of any organization I'm affiliated with, presently or previously. In the South China Sea, I think there's some fundamental challenges there, and one being the United States. I think, at least when I was in government, and I expect continues, although I can't speak for the current government, has serious concerns about China's ambitions in the South China Sea and what it means for security on the ground, or on the water, I should say, but more broadly, its implications for the long-term health and success of a rules-based international order. And that's a high priority for the United States, at least it has been. And one of the challenges that we have is a lot of China's approach, at least a lot of China's justification, is based on Taiwan's history, the old map from 1947. And one of the awkward pieces of this is that Taiwan's approach is toward the South China Sea, I would say, is closer to that of Beijing than that of Washington. And you can see that with the continued support in many areas in Taiwan for the old 11-dash line, not 9-dash line. But you can also see when the Arbitral Tribunal announced its decision, leadership in Taiwan rejected the decision, and quite openly rejected the decision, because it identified Taiping Island or Ituaba as a rock and not an island. And so the challenge there is that because of the United States' serious concerns about China's approach to the South China Sea, Taiwan should not want to get in between that. Should not want to be a problem for the United States in its efforts to deal with Chinese ambitions in the South China Sea. Not to say that this is a major issue in our relationship, but this is about as diplomatic as a Pentagon guy can get. I think it does cause challenges in our relationship.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying. So Abe, could you or anybody else here on the panel think of creative ways that Taiwan could be more helpful in the South China Sea?
Taiwan signed an agreement with Japan some time ago that separated the land ownership issue from the resource management, a fishing agreement. That's a great example for the region. The other one is the fact that not one major environmental non-governmental organization has said a word about the Chinese mining of all this coral out of the South China Sea and the risk that poses to sustainment of marine, life in the South China Sea. The United States has not made much mention of this either. This is something that is in violation of a number of UN agreements that China signed. This goes to Abe's point about no respect for the established international order. If there's a way that we can make a bigger deal out of this, I think it's worth calling out China on this.
So any more comments on South China Sea before I turn over to the North Korea issue. So I wanted to follow up General Gregson. You mentioned during your remarks just now that perhaps later that there might be a possibility for Taiwan, and you mentioned TMD. Is it theater missile defense? Or?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you said later, is it a certain shift in the strategic environment? And is it something as drastic as the 1950s Korea War scenario? Like, how do you envision that turn for the U.S. to offer TMD for Taiwan? So.
The central message that I'm trying to impart is that this has been a long developing capability since at least 1994 when we first became aware of it because the North Koreans made us aware of it. Mm-hmm. We have said since 1994 that this is unacceptable, we can't put up with it, and we are where we are today. So it cannot any longer be business as usual. Polls in South Korea, if I'm not mistaken, there's about 80% of the population that supports reintroduction of U.S. tactical nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula. Argument from the experts is always that, no, this is not militarily necessary. I agree with that. It's not militarily necessary, but if it is perceived by the Koreans to be politically necessary, then yes, we should entertain this. If North Korea's threat continues to develop and it becomes a threat to Taiwan, a credible threat to Taiwan, then yes, we should be talking about how do we better defend Taiwan from an existential threat. And this is going to be, this will be a major issue with the People's Republic, but this is something that we ought to start thinking how we're going to face this now, because we have continued to work on a North Korean problem for a while, and then it goes away in lieu of some other problem, or we develop sanctions that we say this time they're going to work, or we say we're going to have an agreement, or we have a high-level talk going with North Korea. It fades from the headlines. Meantime, North Korean capability keeps progressing. Well, now it gets to the point where our credibility is fundamentally challenged. Our value as an ally is fundamentally challenged. There's a lot of things that we need to do with our allies with the intention of making sure our alliances are just as strong as possible. We've proven, empirical evidence is we can't control North Korea. So let's control what we can control, and that's the faith and trust and bonding amongst our alliances and people-to-people exchanges. We're welcome. Yes, that's absolutely necessary. We also need to, along with all this hard power stuff, we need a much more demonstrative, much louder, much more pervasive conversation about values. Because our talk about values, our talk about human rights, our allegiance to human rights goes right over the heads of authoritarian leaders and directly to their populations, and this causes much discomfort for the authoritarian leaders, meaning Kim Jong-un. And we need a whole-of-government approach again, and it's got to be built on reinforcing our alliance capabilities.
Great. Thank you, General.
So I don't want to speak out of turn as an American, but it seems to me that we focus a lot on showing our capabilities and our military strength as a means to reassure our allies. And I think showing our allies that we have sound judgment is equally, if not more, important than how strong we are, especially now. My main concern about U.S. policy, and I think this affects Taiwan as well as South Korea, is a lot of the policies put forward seem to have a disregard for the people that are actually going to be held at risk as a result of those policy changes. So I'm an advocate in general for being more proactive about manipulating risk when it comes to dealing with North Korea or with China. I think that that's the game that China plays with us of saying, you know, we're willing to let things escalate, are you? And the United States has this a fear based in history that has long been debunked about inadvertent escalation causing world wars that leads the United States to not be willing to do that. So I'm supportive of policies that the United States is willing to take on more risk, but only if the people who are going to pay the price are on board with that. So if the South Koreans, for example, are on board with the United States being more aggressive towards North Korea, or if Taiwan is on board with the United States questioning our policies over the course of years to push China on that, my concern is that type of discussion is not happening, and that there are risks that the United States then pursues strategic interests at which certain individuals or countries peoples are being affected. So the judgment issue, I think, is really important. And when it comes to North Korea, I'll just lay this out there. China has this viewpoint that economic pressure is not going to get North Korea to the table, and they're right, one. And two, denuclearization is never going to happen in the near term through talks. So I think, again, thinking more innovatively about our policies, we haven't tried everything under the sun. Right? We haven't tried to give Kim prestige through other means, for example, like having direct unconditional talks, starting a normalization process that allows the United States to put some people on the ground. And so in the situation that, let's just say the United States wants the end of the regime, we're better positioned to do it internally because we have people on the ground, we have resources, we know who's what where, which we do not know now. And if we want to do it externally, hopefully we have better intel and human intelligence networks to actually tell us where some of those nukes are. But right now, the situation in which we think we're going to be rewarding North Korea by talking to them, you know, I don't care if Kim thinks he wins the day, if in the end he actually loses. And so I think we need to think more broadly about what types of U.S. policies would actually reassure our allies and which ones cause more concern.
Great points, and let me be clear. I'm not opposed to negotiations. I'm not opposed to all the other things that we try to do. But given the immediate appearance of this weapons capability, we have to be doing those talks from the foundation of an undoubted ability to prevail, most of all in the minds of our allies, that we have the ability to prevail. And whatever form that takes, we need to take that form.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Two quick comments. One on the general issue of Taiwan and missile defense, and then the other one about Taiwan, the role that Taiwan can play in terms of how we deal with North Korea. The PLA began missile buildup, let's say 1991, 1993. And it used to be, in terms of policy, when Taiwan first started requesting missile defense systems, whether it's PAC-3 or whether it's the long-range UHF, early warning radar, or THAAD for that matter, back in the late 90s or mid to late 90s, that was a very controversial issue, highly debated within DOD itself and between DOD and state and NSC. Very controversial. It was hard to argue from military. It was hard to argue from military perspective on the radar, what is now known as SRP, and even PAC-3. That's because these systems were inherently strategic, and eventually the U.S. Finally approved these systems, more for undercutting the course of utility more than anything else. What dropped off the scope, though, in 2005, at least from Congress, there used to be regular statements calling on China to renounce use of force. Or at least statements calling on China to be able to at least reduce their missile posture opposite Taiwan. Over the last 10 years, you don't hear that much anymore, whether it's renouncing use of force or reducing their missile posture. The missile posture has leveled off a bit, but it's no wonder that Beijing feels it has it can threaten use of force around its neighbors is because we did not do it, at least over the last 10 years, have done very little to delegitimize their force buildup opposite Taiwan. Politically, I mean, whether statements and other ways. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because we view that, you know, cross-strait military situation as an internal issue and don't feel, that's Beijing would say, it's an internal issue, you can't, that brooks no interference. On the role that Taiwan can play in North Korea, knowing what we know now, if we step back to these debates that took place in the late 90s, particularly with Aegis-equipped destroyers with missile defense, if we knew then what we know now, I don't think there would have been that much of a debate back then, because just imagine, today, Taiwan would have them, all budget issues would be resolved if Taiwan had Aegis-equipped destroyers, missile defense. Just imagine the role that could play these days in terms of patrols and support for at least maintaining situational awareness. Just imagine that. Today, though, Taiwan does have the surveillance radar program, the most powerful radar ever built. UHF operates at very long ranges, and it certainly has the ability to be able to augment whatever capabilities we already have in terms of tracking any North Korean missile flights, and probably already does. I put that out there, and I'm sure Taiwan has a lot of assets and other capabilities they can bring to the table.
Great, thank you.
I'm sorry. Just a couple comments on all this. One, I thought was interesting. We spent a good amount of time talking about North Korea. Just so you all know, in the back, before we came on, we were all talking about how tired we are talking about North Korea, just because it's the issue of the moment. I do think the key, when people in South Korea are talking about the U.S. deploying tactical nuclear weapons, redeploying tactical nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula, that's, in my sense, that's not really about the South Koreans suddenly fell in love with nuclear weapons. To me, it's related to conversations they're having in Japan now about nuclear weapons, about ballistic missiles. These are really reflections of the same thing, which is concern about American extended deterrence guarantees, which will not be solved by deploying tactical nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula, because it's not a technical problem. Secretary Mattis recently made a terrific statement on this. He said, our nuclear deterrence is effective and it doesn't matter where they are, or something to that effect. It's a political commitment. And the concern of the political commitment, I think, is what's driving a lot of these discussions in Korea and Japan. And something that's interesting to me is that you're not seeing similar conversations in Taiwan. And I don't know why, but I think it's an interesting question. And so I wanted to make that out. The other piece, to bring things back to Taiwan, some things that have been said that were said recently. When thinking about North Korea, regardless of your theory of victory, be it preemption, prevention, be it negotiation, be it a freeze, whatever it is, everybody agrees that China is going to play an important role in this because of their connections with North Korea, their economic role, their geography, because of history, politics, et cetera, regardless of your theory of victory with North Korea, China's going to play a larger role. And to that I add the question, would making Taiwan involved in this make that easier or harder? My sense is that it would make things more difficult to bring Taiwan into this equation. I'm also, to be fair, and I'm, as you know, a big supporter of Taiwan. It's hard for me to envision a significant role for Taiwan in this. I think Taiwan has one very serious security challenge. The United States vis-a-vis Taiwan has one serious security challenge, and it's important we stay focused on that. So my instinct, my recommendation is to keep our engagement with Taiwan, keep Taiwan focused on keep our eyes on the prize here, and try to keep North Korea divorced from this issue.
Great, thank you. We don't have much time, so I'd like to turn it to the audience, please. First, just to this gentleman on the right. Sure. Name and affiliation, please.
Holmes Liao, rank and file, concerned citizen. So China's PLA has been preaching the gospel of asymmetric warfare for decades, and to this day they have already achieved certain success, the so-called assassin's mace, right? And this is not just about weapon systems. It goes to ways, means, and end, and so on. So in light of this, I mean, in the world of David versus Goliath, David being Taiwan, what asymmetric warfare capabilities can Taiwan, based on your expert opinions, what can Taiwan develop to counter China's threat in this framework? Thanks.
Do you have your list?
Three quick points. The first, one of my takeaways and lessons learned is that I've stopped trying to make an opinion about what Taiwan needs and doesn't need. You have a democratic elected leadership, and the burden should be on Taiwan democratic elected leaders and senior military leaders to determine what they need without undue influence on how they should use their own money. That's one of the biggest problems in my view. Things didn't used to be this way, where the U.S. makes determinations on what we think is a waste of money or not a waste of money. It never used to be that way. Taiwan very simply used to come in with a list of requests on their own about what they request, and the U.S. determined on whether to approve, defer, or disapprove in a very clear fashion on an annual and regular basis. So in terms of what Taiwan needs and what it doesn't need, I would argue that their political military leadership in particular, should determine their requirements. The term asymmetric warfare, in my view, this term of innovation and asymmetric, it's in the eye of the beholder. Taiwan society is one of the most innovative in the world in a very specific sense. On the asymmetric side, it depends on how you view it, strategically, operationally, or tactically. Warfare inherently is asymmetric. Strategically, Taiwan can do some pretty interesting things at the strategic level, very political, economic, and other things in terms of for deterrence. There's all kinds of ways that they can do that. In my view, when you say the word asymmetric, first thing I think of is diesel electric submarines.
But you're not going to tell them what to get.
No. But that, I can understand. I can understand the requirement and why they've been pursuing it.
One of the comments earlier was talking about interoperability and jointness. One of the absolute necessities for Taiwan would be able to achieve air, land, sea integration and everything that it's doing in defense. Because you will never have the numbers where airplanes can shoot down airplanes with any kind of acceptable exchange ratio given the numbers on the other side of the strait. On the other hand, a cooperative engagement framework, which is built on this air, land, sea interoperability, provides great asymmetric advantages for Taiwan.
And then before we move on, I'd like to just, a moderator, usually I don't jump in, but for this issue, I think Mark and General Gregson did address the asymmetrical part very well. You mentioned assassin's mace, Harvard professor Alistair Ian Johnston, 10 years ago when this was a big topic, ran a textual analysis, and his conclusion, everybody thought, well, what's the secret weapon? You know, this is a secret weapon called assassin's mace. His conclusion from running his, very detailed, large quantitative analysis on the text was that it's a way for Chinese to say it's a trump card rather than it's a specific military capability, like an asymmetrical capability. So just to clarify on that point. And I'd like to take a few rounds of bundling questions because we're running really short on time. So let's start with Nadia and then Professor Brown and then maybe one more after. And then this gentleman in the back. Those three, and then we'll bundle another set after.
Hi, Nadia Chow with the Liberty Times. I have two questions. The first question is that some of the Taiwanese official or scholar complain that the PLA is sending carriers and the air fighters, to go around the Taiwan Strait for trainings and even a sortie. But we haven't really heard any you know, outspoken statement from the U.S. I wonder why, if you were sitting on the table, you know, giving advice to the policymaker, what would you, you know, suggest? And the second question is, you know, I heard that there's a disengagement in the dialogue between the U.S. and Taiwan in the recent Montreal talk. Maybe it has been going on for a while, as Dan just, you know, you mentioned, people have a different concept about the symbolism or what's, you know, what's really work for Taiwan's defense. I wonder why the, you know, what's the key issue here that you think, you know, that both sides should pay attention? Thank you.
And then Professor Brown, please.
Yeah. Thank you, David. David Brown from Johns Hopkins SAIS. I want to ask about Taiwan's reserve system. This may seem like a strange question, but RAND came out with a report recently on it, which I found very illuminating. I took three things away from that report. One was that the current reserve system is not militarily significant. 1 week every 2 year commitment isn't significant, and a well-respected Taiwan defense person told me the system's a joke. Secondly, a system run by the Ministry of National Defense does not seem to be inspiring active, positive, enthusiastic participation from the public. Quite the contrary. And thirdly, at the end of the report, it analyzed what impact the reserve system was having on the PRC. And it said that even though defense planners look at this system, that to the best that the people who wrote the paper could determine, policymakers don't consider the reserve system a factor that needs to be taken into account. Now, if that's the case, it tells me that this is a system that needs a very fundamental rethink. And I believe this work by RAND probably reflects an interest by the U.S. government in this issue. So I'm wondering whether you could comment on what kind of a role the U.S. might play in trying to encourage a rethink of Taiwan's reserve system towards the direction of making it a significant factor in deterring the PRC. Thank you.
Taiwan reserves. And then third question back there, please.
Hi, Paul Huang from the Epoch Times. So a few days ago, Dr. Sui Mae Terry, she's an American expert in Korea issues. She was quoted, she worked for the, she was an analyst for the National Security Council before. She was quoted in Korean newspaper Chau Song as saying that the United States could possibly consider letting Taiwan have nuclear weapon if things with North Korea going any further, going any worse. If I'm not mistaken, this will be the first time that a former U.S. official who's that seriously entertaining such an idea, putting aside the question of delivery vehicle or target selections or numbers required for viable deterrence, all those things, technical things, just on the strategic level, what, how would such idea even work out? How, like, would the United States just give news to Taiwan or How can Taiwan develop that on its own? And what do you see? Is this like a pipe dream, or is this something that can actually happen? Thank you.
Great, thank you. So the three questions are from Nadia, from advice to policymaker, especially on the symbolism of Taiwan defense. Then we talked about the Taiwan Reserve System, especially the RAND report, which, by the way, one of the key authors, Ian Easton, is in the back right here. So maybe we could set up a sidebar conversation between you two after. And third, the possibility of nuclear weapons for Taiwan, which Taiwan did explore with CSIST decades ago. But
if I can say a quick thing about the reserves before I actually have to step out to go teach. So when I was in Taiwan, this is something that I enjoyed talking about a lot. Obviously, being a reservist myself, I have a bit more kind of personal experience or in-depth knowledge of the reservist system in the United States. So sort of two main points that I would make. The first one, I think, is your assessment of the reserves not really in Taiwan being of strategic significance to contributing to defense is probably right. But it's important to note that that's the case for most reserve systems for most countries in the world. So I've, you know, this is anecdotal, but I've been participating in a lot of these like leadership type of things, which you do exchanges with all different countries. And for a lot of countries, they don't have this sort of joint force concept that the United States does. And to be fair, the United States, that's a relatively new concept. Our reserve has evolved a lot since September 11th. So at least in the Air Force, I don't know about all the services, but the training is exactly the same, whether you're a reservist or you're active duty. So I had to take leave from my PhD for almost 2 years to be in school to train. And now I'm on duty 2 to 3 months every single year, in which I'm full time, right? So that's a huge time commitment. But part of that is probably money, right? The biggest issue, I think, with sort of recruitment and retaining is money and then opportunities, because one of the things that's really great about being a reservist is the development opportunities. I've deployed to Korea twice. I get to do all sorts of interesting things. So along those lines, I would just say for the United States as well, we have 4 different types of reservists. Most people don't know. They think TRs, 2 weeks, 2 weeks a year, 1 weekend a month type of thing, that's only one of the 4 systems that we have. So I myself only work with active duty units on a full-time, part-time basis. So that type of flexibility as well, I think, is a good recruitment tool. And so I've spoken kind of with people in various countries about ways they can move their reservist systems forward, because at least I'm obviously biased, but I think the reserve force in the United States does contribute a great deal to the national defense and security of this nation.
Singapore is an Asian country. It's got a very effective reserve. There may be some lessons learned there that we can do. I think a bigger problem in Taiwan is that as Taiwan's shifting from conscript to volunteer force, we have not made the proper signals to the young population in Taiwan that their service is valued. What form this signaling would take is best decided by Taiwan, but given Taiwan's interest in high-tech industry, given Taiwan's interest in education, maybe there's a GI Bill type thing that would provide incentives for young people to join the armed forces to further their education, as Oriana said about development. The other is doctrine. This was mentioned before in one of the other sessions. I'm not sure that there is an understanding of how Taiwan would defend Taiwan that translates down to the young people. To put it in blunt terms, just for illustration, not trying to be mean, I think the ground forces suffer from this the worst, because they have the very limited amount of training areas compared to the air and the sea forces. And the ground force doctrine looks a lot like the doctrine we left Taiwan with when the military alliance ended. And things have marched on since then. There's better ways to do it. And as we get more effective concepts, I think there's a natural appeal then to the youngsters that we're trying to recruit in Taiwan for the active duty volunteer force as well as the reserve force.
Just very quickly on the question about the carrier. I can't speak to what the U.S. May say. Maybe you could ask Dave Helvey later today. But my personal reaction was that I wouldn't want to be in a position where I would say that certain ships could not sail in certain areas. That if it's in international waters, then carriers can sail, be they Chinese or whatever. And I wouldn't want to try to put a restriction on freedom of navigation for any country. And I thought it was interesting that China's action may have implicitly stated that they see military transit through international waters as being legitimate. So that was really my only reaction there. And I really can't comment to Sue's proposal. I hadn't seen it, so I don't want to comment too much on it, but I think that there's a bit, recently, and I'll just speak generally, there's been a lot of loose talk about countries developing nuclear weapons that don't have them before. And I think it's a very serious issue that requires serious analysis. And thinking through the tremendous political, economic, and security implications of any of these countries pursuing, let alone developing these capabilities, are enormous and should not be taken lightly. And so blithely saying, you know, if this country, then this country, then this country, I think does a disservice to those countries, to those security. I think it requires very serious analysis and consideration.
To address or try to address your question on the reserve force, and if I say anything wrong, Ian can either back me up or refute me. Taiwan has a very large reserve force, and if they're even able to mobilize a fraction of these in a contingency, it would be a significant plus up, a significant addition to the capabilities that are already in play. I would add to that, looking at it's interesting. You can actually look at Taiwan's overall central government budget on a year-to-year basis, and they just put, including the defense budget, extreme detail. Every service, every program, with some exceptions. There is a classified portion, but it's increasingly small. And looking at the personnel part of the budget, the Armed Force Reserve Command is equal to, if not more, than the personnel budget of each of the major three services. That's, to me, it's an interesting fact. I'm looking at 12 NT, let's say rough it up to maybe let's call it about 13 billion. It's pretty significant. And one other quick point on the reserve force. It's easy to criticize Taiwan for not putting enough into the reserve force, not enough training. It's a little bit harder to think about what we as Americans could do to be able to create the conditions in which reserve force would be more politically palatable among your electorate and your voter base in Taiwan. This is where some symbolism actually has substance in and of itself. What if, for example, we had a DASD, a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs, that actually made a visit to Taiwan, tried to keep it low-key, but what about something like that, if that happened? Eventually it's going to get out, but that would add to some of the emphasis, and then establish a dialogue or some sort of a bilateral working group on reserve affairs. How about having officers from Reserve Command actually attend U.S. schools, whether it's in the National Defense University or other organizations? I just throw that out for consideration. On the symbolism issue, again, I'd emphasize security competition in the Taiwan Strait. I think it's been said before, and I think it still exists today, 70% political, 30% military. In the Taiwan Strait, symbolism is substance. Last November, President Trump made a phone call in Taiwan. It was written off here in the U.S. as being symbolic. I think if you asked, if you had interlocutors in Beijing and in Taipei, if that was symbolic, I think they would say no, it was substantive.
Great, thank you. This has been really great back and forth, but the organizer is cutting me off because of time. But we are going to coffee break, so please, with your questions, come up and talk to us. And reminder, we have hot mics, so whatever you say is going to be broadcast. All right, thank you very much. Please.